So, when you hear the word Woodstock, what instantly pops into your head? Like mud, right? Jimi Hendrix playing guitar, 500,000 people in a giant field in 1969.
Oh, definitely. It's, the ultimate hippie fever dream.
Right. But here's the thing that just completely broke my brain today, that famous festival. It didn't actually happen in Woodstock.
Yeah, not even close. I mean, it actually happened on Max Yasgur's dairy farm down in Bethel, New York, which is like 60 miles away.
60 miles. That is a totally different place.
It is. And the actual town of Woodstock flat out rejected the festival. They didn't want it anywhere near them.
Okay, let's unpack this because that is wild. Today's deep dive is into a recent editorial from The Edit about what Woodstock actually is. And we are going to show you how a town's true identity is built on, well, a century of practice, not just one viral moment.
Yeah, exactly. Because, if you rewind all the way back to 1902, that is 67 years before the festival even happened.
1902.
Yeah, 1902. You have to look at this utopian experiment called Birdcliff. It's actually America's oldest continuously operating arts and crafts colony.
Oh, wow. I had no idea it was that old.
Right. And it was founded as this direct response to rapid industrialization. Their whole motto was head, heart, and hand. So instead of, buying machine-cut furniture or factory textiles, they bought 1,500 acres on a mountain to hand-carve wood and weave their own fabrics.
So it wasn't just a philosophy, it was like a literal daily workshop. But I mean, utopias usually crash and burn pretty fast. People get sick of each other, right? How does a place like that sustain a culture for a century?
By fracturing and adapting. And what's fascinating here is how they survived that exact problem. Birdcliff was heavily managed from the top down by a wealthy founder, which got super rigid.
Naturally, nobody likes a micromanager, especially in an art commune.
Exactly. So in 1905, two of the founders just quit. Hervey White led the charge, bought land across town, and started a new, messy democratic colony called Maverick.
Oh, so it's like a classic rock band breaking up over creative differences.
That is the perfect way to put it. Maverick was a co-op where everyone actually shared the chores. It was built entirely on volunteer labor.
And they even built this rustic concert hall using timber and nails from a working farm, right?
Yes. And that physical infrastructure is the mechanism that drove everything else. That volunteer-built barn became the home of Maverick Concerts, which is the oldest continuously running summer chamber music festival in the country.
Which is wild.
It really is. By actually building a space for weird acoustic art, they attracted people who wanted to push boundaries.
Which perfectly explains 1952, the John Cage premiere. This is my favorite part.
Oh, it's so good. He premiered his famous piece, 433, right there in that hand-built Maverick barn.
Wait, for anyone who doesn't know, that's the one where the pianist literally plays nothing for 4.5 minutes, right?
That's the one. The pianist sat there, and the audience just listened to the wind in the trees. It proved Woodstock had the infrastructure to practice avant-garde art, not just talk about it in coffee shops.
Okay, but jumping forward to the 60s and 70s, the 1969 festival happened elsewhere, but Woodstock still had a massive music scene. The soil was already prepped.
Oh, for sure. Because Maverick proved acoustic music could thrive there. That's why the band felt so at home renting a pink house nearby to record the basement tapes with Bob Dylan in 67.
Right, and in 1975, Levon Helm from the band built his own acoustically engineered barn right in Woodstock for his midnight rambles.
Yeah, which his family actually still runs today.
But hold on, let me push back here. If the town hated the 69 festival, isn't it kind of hypocritical that they reap all the cultural tourism from it now? I mean, why not just lean into the merch and coast on the fame?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the editorial points out that when small towns get swallowed by a single famous moment, they basically turn into theme parks. They lose their soul.
So they just become a giant gift shop.
Exactly. They stop making things and just sell souvenirs of that one time they did something cool. Woodstock survived the gravitational pull of 1969 because it ignored the noise and kept operating its actual workshop.
Right. It's the difference between being a souvenir shop and a living studio. Like how the Golden Notebook, that independent bookstore there, has been hosting authors since the late 70s.
Yeah. And the Woodstock Film Festival started in 2000 and just kept running. They didn't freeze themselves in amber in 1969. Identity is the boring daily work of keeping a bookstore open or repairing a barn roof so chamber musicians can play.
That really flips the script on what makes a place culturally valuable. Like, think about the last viral sensation you saw in your city. A flash mob or a trendy pop-up shop. Now compare that to a local theater that's been scraping by, building sets every weekend for 30 years.
Exactly. Continuity is the true unit of cultural value. Founders don't have to scale. but institutions absolutely must adapt to survive.
That is such a good point. So the next time you drive through your own town, or, you know, any small town, really, look past the gift shops and the welcome signs. Ask yourself, what has this place actually been practicing for 100 years?